From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. George Clinton is the master of funk. He's combined soul and acid rock, pioneered rap, and created one of the most outrageous stage acts in music. He has his first new album in 5 years. Coming up, we meet the man behind the Atomic Dog. Also today, we talk with writer Bobby Louise Hawkins. Her new book is a collection of short essays, stories, recollections, and quotations, all arranged by the letters of the alphabet. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the 60s vocal group The Jive Five, and book critic John Leonard reviews David Lodge's new novel Nice Work, about a professor and a businessman who totally confuse each other. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The leaders of the Contra rebels say it will be up to their men to decide whether to comply with the latest Central American peace plan calling for them to disband. The presidents of 5 Central American countries signed the agreement yesterday, setting out a timetable for the demobilization of an estimated 10,000 Contras camped in Honduras. Alan Tomlinson has been talking with rebel leaders in Miami.
Contra leaders had made it known beforehand that they would not lay down their arms or disband their army until after democracy returns to Nicaragua. That objective, they say, has still not been reached. Speaking in Miami after the signing of the latest plan, rebel leader Adolfo Calero emphasized that the Contras are not bound to comply with the agreement.
It's a voluntary demobilization, and we will pass that on to our men. They are going to make a decision. A voluntary decision, and they have 3 options open.
Those options are to accept amnesty and return to Nicaragua, become refugees in other countries, or re-enter Nicaragua under arms. 3,000 rebels are still in Nicaragua observing an ongoing ceasefire, Calero said. But he accepted that it would not be easy to continue the rebel war without renewed American assistance, and that prospect seems even less likely now. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Miami.
The Japanese parliament has elected a new prime minister, the third this year, for the scandal-plagued position. William Horsley reports on the man who was tapped for the post.
Mr. Kaifu's election as prime minister is a foregone conclusion, as the Liberal Democrats still have a majority in the all-important lower house of the Japanese parliament, though they've lost control in the upper house. After defeating 2 lesser-known candidates in the contest for the party leadership, Mr. Kaifu outlined his plans for revising an unpopular sales tax and tightening the law on political funds to stop anything like the recruit scandal from happening again. But the 58-year-old Mr. Kaifu still has to prove that he has leadership qualities. And so far, Mr. Kaifu has failed to pledge tough action against politicians caught up in the recruit affair, as the Japanese public has been demanding. Mr. Kaifu himself has acknowledged receiving lawful donations from the controversial recruit company. That alone should not harm him, but he must show that, unlike his predecessor, Mr. Uno, he's more than a creature of the recruit-tainted party bosses who've now made him their nominal leader.
The BBC's William Horsley. The wife of Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins said it is virtually certain that her husband is dead, and she offered her support to President Bush as he tries to save the living and end the suffering. Robin Higgins, a Marine Corps major, told reporters that the time had come to tell her husband, "We love him and we miss him." On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 4 points to close at 2699.17. Advances led declines 8-7. This is NPR News. Poor visibility hampered rescuers searching today for a plane carrying Texas Representative Mickey Leland and 13 other people that vanished en route to a refugee camp near the Sudanese border. Heavy cloud cover made an aerial search of more than 400 miles of rugged terrain from the capital to Leland's destination in southwestern Ethiopia nearly impossible. At a briefing in Washington, Leland's press secretary Alma Newsom said President Bush had telephoned Leland's wife in Houston to express his concern and assure her the U.S. government had offered full assistance to Ethiopia. The Canadian Supreme Court has struck down an injunction that barred a 21-year-old woman from having an abortion. The ruling followed a shocking announcement from the woman's attorney earlier in the day, as Richard Reynolds reports from Toronto.
Chantal Daigue has spent the past month under a court order preventing her from having an abortion. The order was the result of a suit filed by her former boyfriend, who had asked the courts to save his unborn child. Midway through a submission by one lawyer, the Chief Justice interrupted the proceedings and asked Daigle's lawyer if he had something to tell the court. The lawyer then confirmed that Daigle had defied the court order and had an abortion, probably earlier today. Daigle could face charges of contempt of court and up to 2 years in jail. And Daigle's decision to have the abortion while the Supreme Court was considering her case will add a new and unexpected twist to the raging abortion debate in Canada. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
Oliver North today was supposed to begin serving his sentence of 1,200 hours of community service with the new inner-city anti-drug youth project in the District of Columbia. But project officials say North's probation officer told them this morning that North would not begin his new job today. The program coordinator said officials were told that U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell delayed North's work in an effort to avert expected media coverage. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. If funk began with James Brown, it was my guest George Clinton who was responsible for many of the innovations in the funk music of the 70s and 80s. He brought electronics into his rhythm tracks and used a guitar sound inspired by acid rock. His songs had repetitive group vocals with witty lyrics that rock critic Ken Tucker called aggressively vulgar and brilliantly literate. Clinton created a funk empire, which included the bands Parliament, Funkadelic, P-Funk, and the Brides of Funkenstein. Parliament and Funkadelic had the same musicians, but Clinton presented his more polished material through Parliament. Funkadelic was wild and improvisational and put on extravagant stage shows that incorporated science fiction plots and elaborate mythologies. The musicians wore outlandish costumes and hairdos. In his alter ego of Dr. Funkenstein, Clinton sometimes made his stage entrance from a flying saucer. Since 1982, Clinton has also recorded under his own name. He had a hit in 1983 with Atomic Dog. He's just released his first new album in over 5 years. This is the title track, The Cinderella Theory. That Cinderella Theory, the title track from George Clinton's new album. George Clinton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Yeah, I just got defleed and got the ticks off of me. I got my doggy bag, and I'm going to go get my rabies shots, and I'll be ready for them. How you doing, baby?
Okay. What got you back in the studios and on the road after 5 years?
Oh, I got tired of laying up being an old dog and not learning new tricks. So I said, let me get back out there, because, you know, when rap started getting heavy like it is now, I said, that's an old trick right there. I can do that. So here I am, back out here talking stuff.
How do you feel when a rapper uses one of your rhythm tracks on one of their
records? I love it. Uh-huh. Well, you know, the ones that use too long, they pay.
And right.
The rest of them keep us alive. I mean, like, who's it? Me, Myself, and I.
Right, yeah.
That particular one, I'm glad they did that one, because, I mean, it brought my whole thing back to life. Plus, they paid good.
Mm-hmm.
De La Soul, the company paid real good. But the main thing is that it brings you back to life if you know how to use it. Like, they did it with James Brown, too. And what I did and I learned from him was that I didn't get upset. I figured out a way to benefit from it. So I sample my record back off of theirs and some of theirs.
Well, I'd be curious in hearing about what music you first heard that made you want to make music yourself.
Oh, wow. I can almost tell you precisely what it was. It was Why Do Fools Fall in Love.
Frankie Lyman.
Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. I was about 13. I started Parliament probably a year later, right around the same time. So Parliament's been around since about 56. But that was the record, Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And the Spaniels, of course. Most people would know nostalgically, Good Night, Sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go. A lot of people remember that one, but I remember some of their earlier doo-wop records, and they were the ones that actually made me want to, excuse me, you know, to really get into it. And plus, you know, in Newark, New Jersey, where I grew up at, everybody either sang or boxed or played ball. I tried boxing. That wasn't happening. I played ball, you know, I had a team, baseball team. They kicked me off my own team. So then I got my group together, and that's been working pretty good ever since.
Well, at the same time that you were singing with your group, the Parliaments, you were also running a hair salon, right?
Well, that was later on. I started the Parliament, say, 56. By 59, I was working in a barbershop, you know, processing hair. You know, that go right along with the doo-wops. You know, you get your hair done, and you go stand on the corner and sing all day and night.
Mm-hmm. Let me get back to when you were in the barbershop, and you were conking people's hair. How were you wearing your hair at the time?
Conk, too. How did you know that phrase? You ain't supposed to know that phrase. That's the inside phrase. Conk is a real old one. That's what it was, though. I was wearing my hair the same way. Matter of fact, there's pictures around with, you know, hair slick, looking good, you know, waves. Make you seasick to look at my head. But it all worked real good for us because everybody in the band worked in the barbershop at that time.
Was style very important to you then?
Styles?
Mm-hmm. Was style very important, being stylish?
Style has always been important. That's why I think we are able to survive so much now. I can see styles coming long before they get here, and I can pretty much tell what goes with the style. So as I see it approaching, I try to jump into it early, and I can divorce myself from any previous styles as that being the only style in the world, which is what a lot of people have trouble doing, because the industry will tell you that ain't your bag, and you get trapped in a style or a setting. But having worked in a barbershop, styles was for, you know, fit faces or fit the time, if it was Easter or Christmas. You had all kind of styles that you could relate to. And like I said, faces. So you had a lot of variety of styles to appreciate. So I transferred that into music. And my whole life has been like one big style after another. And it all looked like, wow, he's been doing that all his life. You know, I forget that I have hair like I've got now. When I see somebody looking, I don't get upset because that's what I do for the attention. But I forget because it's so natural.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to play the first hit that you had back when your group was called the Parliaments.
Oh, my God. Ooh, luscious. You know, that was a big record in Detroit. That record broke right here in Detroit. I was back at the barbershop and giving up for a minute.
Well, here it is, George Clinton's first hit back from 1967, I Just Want to Testify. From 1967, that's George Clinton, the Parliaments.
Well, it sounds good to hear that again.
Yeah, it sounds really good. You were saying that when that record was a hit, you were working for Joe Bett, the publishing company of Motown Records. I once read you say that there was a lot you didn't like about Motown. You didn't like the idea of everybody in the group dressing alike and doing the same steps.
Not that we didn't like it. We loved it. But we just couldn't see ourselves overcoming the temptations or the pips. First of all, the temptation was from here, and the criteria for that, you know, at that time was height, you know, 6 feet. As a matter of fact, they all were 6 feet. And we were like 5, 6, 2, 3. You know, I mean, we was all over the place. It wasn't uniform. And the routines and things we had perfect. And the suits, of course, we had perfect. And the styles was perfect. But there was no way to outdo the Pips with the routine. They were the best routine and group that I've ever seen. And the Temptation had the perfect image, plus this was home for them. So it wasn't that we didn't like it. It was just no way for us to overcome the competition within the company. So we just threw the suit. And plus, it was hard to keep ties alike or shirts clean. Anyway, that was the hardest part of all. And so it was convenient when we realized that hippies and rock and roll and blues was the exact opposite of what we had been into all our life, because we could do this having fun. We'd wear the clothes bag as opposed to the suit. We'd take the suit out and throw it down and cut holes in the clothes bag and put it on. You know, and it became just a big joke at first. But the music was always, like, very soulful, churchy, you know, like Maggot Brain, psychedelic. You know, nobody had seen black groups doing psychedelic. They used to call us Temptations on Acid or James Brown on Acid, you know. But it always worked. And so we just, you know, changed our whole thing and went that way. So it wasn't that we didn't like the routines and things. It's just that it was convenient for us to go a different route.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. George Clinton is my guest, and he has his first record out.
I have to get those out every now and
then. He has his first record out in 5 years, and we'll be hearing more from it in a few minutes. The album's called The Cinderella Theory. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is George Clinton. He founded the Parliaments in the 50s, later formed the psychedelic funk band Funkadelic. He's also just released his first new album in 5 years. It's called The Cinderella Theory. You were just saying that people used to call your group the Temptations on Acid. Were you doing a lot of acid yourself during that period? And what effect did psychedelics have on the kind of performances and stage shows you wanted to do?
Of course, you know, at that particular time, everybody did acid, mm-hmm. you know, and I did my share and two or three other people's share probably. But at the time, I wasn't into equating it or analyzing it as it being the thing that helped us, even though later on, after I felt safe enough distance from that whole era, you know, and I love the era, but, you know, once you start to seeing that it was over, you start being afraid, then you say, oh, I made it through that. Then I realized that, okay, it did break me out of that mode of the streets of New York, New Jersey, the rat race that tend to make you feel like I got to do it to them before they do it to me. It definitely helped us all from that particular, because we was growing up into that, and that's what we would have been.
Since your music was inspired both by soul and funk, but also by acid rock, I was wondering if it was ever hard to kind of get accepted by both black and white audiences.
Both black, we could help with both black and white. You know, we was too black for most white audience, because there were so many of us. They could take Jimi Hendrix and, you know, the couple white guys, but here you had 10 guys up there acting all like they were from, you know, Newark, and we were. But it was all in fun. I think that one kept us alive for part-time, and then the other one kept us alive, you know, as far as surviving. There was a core or cult following of, say, Maggot Brain fans or white fans from Boston, Toronto, parts of Michigan, you know, and Cleveland, in all the colleges, we had a good audience. And then towards the 71, it started being like a lot of black. We did America East is Young. A lot of the black audience started showing up. And by the time we did Cosmic Slop, it was really both, you know, but both wouldn't come to the other show. So we still had to do different places altogether.
Since you've done some barking for us already on the show, I thought I'd play Atomic Dog, which is one of the hits under the George Clinton name.
Yeah, y'all better get your doggy bags out now. Get your ticks out of there, okay?
Would you give us a sense of how this record came together?
Well, basically, we were off, you know, off the road for a couple of years, and it was the type of record that we had to put out, because we're still going through litigation with the record companies and everything and reorganizing the thing. It was a record that I put out on my own first solo album. And I was trying new things because, you know, we didn't have nothing to worry about whether we got played or not. So I tried some different type things. And so Atomic Dog was just the kind of life I probably was living at the moment. I don't know intellectually really what made me do it, but I think we was getting felt dogged out by the record companies about our whole lifestyle or whatever was going on in the streets. Since we weren't working, you know, you tend to get back into all of the party things. And I think I was feeling dogged out, probably was dogging myself out at the time. But I just know I walked in the studio one day and just started singing. I didn't even know what I was singing about. And that's the way it came. And most of our songs come like that. We make sense out of it later. Somebody come along and say, did you mean so-and-so and so-and-so? And if it sounds real hip, I say, yeah, that's what I mean.
This is George Clinton's Atomic Dog.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. For the dog that chases its tail, house dog, street dog. Dog of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, kind dog. Funky dogs, nasty dogs.
Oh.
That's George Clinton's Atomic Dog. How did you start moving from singing to also producing and doing these really far out rhythm tracks? I know you were always producing. You produced the Parliaments records, but it really became like a specialty of yours.
Well, after I realized that it was going to take more than one group to survive and, you know, and make it, any one group, it could be stopped any kind of ways or just be stopped because they're not good enough. But I think if you have a number of outlets for your stuff, when one style is saying that you're over with, another one will be saying that, oh, this is the new thing. So not only did Parliament Funkadelic, we did Bootsy, you know, as an offshoot, the Brides, the Horny Horns, everybody that was in the band. So that gave me a lot of different outlets because so many members in the band can write and would have liked to have their own group, but they didn't want the hassles. So it was easy for me to utilize all the people in the band, and it kept my outlet wide open. Like right now, we got Funkadelic just released on MCA. My son is on, Tracy is on the Warner Brothers. I'm doing a guy called Babbling Kababy, and his record is like really funky. It'll be out pretty soon. And so I'm always continually cutting music and trying to keep another thing happening, because when they say it's over with this planned obsolescence trip, you know, if you ain't got but that one record, you got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you not only have a lot of different bands that you've created and produced, you also have different alter egos that you've performed under, like Dr. Funkenstein.
Dr. Funkenstein, Mr. Wiggles, Sir Nose.
Would you describe one of your alter egos for our listeners who haven't seen you perform?
Okay, well, Sir Nose, you know, I would never dance. I should never dance. Nobody can make me dance. I don't even make love. That voice, you know, harmonized on it, made it real high. But the voice was actually, I was imitating one of the guys that used to work in the barbershop, or used to come to the barbershop all the time. He had, you know, all the girls liked him. He was real cool, but he, as far as I was concerned, he was crazy. I mean, this dude stabs his car, you know, but he was a fun dude, and everybody liked him, and he was cool, but at the same time, he was a nut. And when I told him, like, you know, maybe 6, 7 years ago that I had been imitating him with that voice, it tickled him because, you know, he's a grown man now and he remembered those things. But most of the voice, I usually use a character out of the barbershop because, you know, the thing in the barbershop is to get up and tell lies. When I saw Sugar Ray fight Joe Louis in 27, Richard Pryor always do it. Those are the kind of things that always happen in barbershops. And I found that they work good on record. You know, like, make my funk the P-funk. I want my funk uncut. All of those are, you know, slang that's used, like, in the streets or in the barbershop. And you find more of it in the barbershop than you do anywhere. So a lot of the characters were based on people who I know their personality was penetrating when I did it. Dr. Funkenstein was like a FM disc jockey. W-E-F-U-N-K, We Funk, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, bringing you music to get your together by. You know, and all of those things were like just different places I know that was penetrating. And I knew that the DJ was missing off of radio. They had started doing the cartridge thing. So the personalities that you used to hear on the radio, like, let me see. Attention on radio station jocks. You got to be serious slamming on my box, because when I try my best to get into the decibels, up so high that my neighbors call the cops. So when the thing get to tweaking, you know the groove is peaking. I mean harder than a cinder block. Okay, I know you know what I mean. I keep a party tweaking on my record machine. You know, and those kind of things, or those kind of jocks is like missing off of radio now. And, you know, and I figured, well, if I put this on Mothership Connection, it was the right thing at that time. And it's what most rappers tell me now that they got, or they learned rapping from, the Mothership Connection album.
You know, you're, I think, 48 now, nearing in on 50.
Just got to 48.
Okay. do you ever worry, though, about if your image will have to change as you get a little older, like tone down from the kind of extravagance and sexual innuendo, you know, in the performances?
I changed. That changed a long time ago, sexual innuendos in you outdoors. And that, you know, it's redirected from, like, I wouldn't go to the front stage and flirt with the 13-year-old girls, but I would still probably say something really funky or dirty. You can always change that to fit whatever age, you know, and it's all the same. But I don't worry about that. As long as I don't be walking around here looking like this with no possible way of hit records, you know, if I don't have no possible way of hit records, then I told everybody around me, make sure I get rid of this Baby Jane look. You hip to Baby Jane, right? You know, so if I don't have no possible, and as long as I got some kind of reason to think that I got a record coming out, I don't mind looking different or weird or whatever, because to me it's only a style. But if it don't look like I'm ever going to put a record out, I tell everybody, remind me to cut this off my head.
You know, when we were setting up this interview with you, we found out that you don't have a telephone. And I couldn't imagine why.
I haven't had one for about 10 years. The mothership can get in touch with you if it's need to be in touch with somebody. You don't really realize how much you don't need a lot of things until you... I mean, I know most people think I'm crazy then, for real, but the majority of things that you depend on, like, as lifeblood, is not really that.
I regret that we're out of time. It's really been wonderful to have you here. Thank
you.
Thank you very much for doing the interview. Thanks for being here. My guest has been George Clinton. His new album, The Cinderella Theory, is on Warner Brothers Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with film director James Cameron. He brought Arnold Schwarzenegger to the screen as the Terminator and created the popular horror film Aliens. His new movie is the underwater thriller The Abyss. I hope you can join us. Here's more from George Clinton's new album. This is Why Should I Dog You Out?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The letter A begins with a story about an abortionist. Under F, there's a tale about the world's biggest jumping frog. And if you turn to the letter G, you find a news clipping about suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge. Bobby Louise Hawkins' new book, My Own Alphabet, covers all 26 letters with a mix of memoir, fiction, and epigram. Coming up from A to Z with Bobby Louise Hawkins. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of Eugene Pitt. In the early 60s, Pitt was a doo-wop singer facing the end of the doo-wop era. But Ed explains how Pitt stuck with it and in the process made some great records. And book critic John Leonard reviews Nice Work by David Lodge. It's a comic novel that jumps between the halls of academe and the world of big business. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. A special United Nations envoy today asked Israel to release a kidnapped Hezbollah leader in a bid to end the hostage crisis in Lebanon. But after a nearly hour-long meeting in Tel Aviv, U.S. envoy Merrick Golding said Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin stood firmly by Israel's offer of only a swap for Israeli and Western hostages. Golding says there's a wide gap between the position of Israel and the United Nations. President Bush today promised to do all he can to prevent discrimination and to make economic redevelopment an opportunity available in America's inner cities. Michael Richards has more from the White House on Bush's speech.
My administration is committed to reaching out to minorities, to striking down barriers to free and open access. We will not tolerate discrimination, bigotry, or bias of any kind. Period.
The president stressed that he sees economic development as the key and outlined proposals to create inner city enterprise zones. The president said businesses that invest in them should be rewarded with tax breaks, including complete freedom from capital gains levies. While many civil rights leaders say Bush appears much more accessible and concerned than President Reagan was, they also say they've seen more rhetoric than substance from him. But they add that they're heartened by his recent endorsement of legislation extending civil rights laws to disabled people. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
The Bush administration is expressing reservations about the new Central American peace agreement that calls for the voluntary demobilization of the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Under the terms of the agreement reached by the Central American presidents, the Contras are asked to voluntarily give up their weapons by December 8th and return home to Nicaragua. But administration spokesmen say they doubt the Nicaraguan government will have enacted political reforms to guarantee the rebels' safety and democratic rights. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the agreement endorses past Central America peace accords that call for the Sandinistas to democratize their country.
Now, words must be followed by actions by those who continue to violate the Esquipulas Agreement if democracy, security, and peace are to come in Central America. We hope that those governments and groups which have refused to abide by the commitments of Esquipulas will now comply with the summit mandate.
The State Department is calling on the Nicaraguan government to engage in a direct dialogue to discuss terms for the Contras' return. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Canada today, the Supreme Court struck down an injunction that barred a woman from having an abortion. The ruling came only hours after 21-year-old Chantal Dagg went ahead with the procedure. Dagg's lawyers asked the court to consider the case anyway, saying Dagg faced contempt of court charges. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 4.18 points today to close at 2699.17. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, tells us that when members of his trade need a fact confirmed about one or another vanished vocal harmony group, they can turn to Eugene Pitt. Pitt used to be the leader of the Jive Five and has become an inveterate collector of artifacts from the doo-wop era. Today, Ed profiles Pitt's own career.
Hurry back, back home to me.
Every so often, rock and roll goes through spasms, where the tried and the true are upset, discarded, cast by the wayside in favor of newer, more urgent sounds. This was the situation in 1961, when the rhythm and blues charts saw the beginning of a revolution. Thanks to the innovations of people like Jackie Wilson, Sam Cooke, and others, a new kind of music was coming into being, a kind that would become known as soul. So what Eugene Pitt should have done is simple. He should either have changed what he was doing, which only the bravest and most talented could do, or he should have done what most people in his position were doing and just quit. But Pitt had had a taste of success when he and some of his high school friends had recorded a song called Who's That Knockin', and it had gotten lots of airplay around New York. The group called themselves the Genies, but right as the record took off, they broke up. Two of them went on to fame as Don and Juan, whose hit What's Your Name is an oldies perennial. But Eugene was mad. He was a good songwriter, a good singer, and a good leader of groups. So what if doo-wop was over? He pounded the pavements of New York until he found a label crazy enough to come out to see his group perform.
Where is the story that I must tell?
Tone Records was riding high with Bobby Lewis's single Tossin' and Turnin', and they had money to spare, so they took Pitt's group into the studio and, after 21 takes, got one of the most perfect harmony records ever recorded, My True Story. Beltone must have believed in the record because they let Pitt use the goofy name he'd given his group, the Jive Five, and they promoted the record relentlessly. It took months, which was more unusual then than it is now, but the record finally took off, and it reached the number one slot for a great deal of the summer of 1961. Maybe it was the novelty factor that sold My True Story, because they never got a follow-up. Golden Rings charted briefly at the end of 1962, and Beltone and the Jive Five parted company. This was too bad because they'd left some great stuff, more modern sounding, in the can there. Now is when Eugene really should have given up, and it's true, during the next couple of years, he studied to be a mortician so he'd have a trade. But he also kept his dream alive, and in 1965, with Motown in full flower, Stax starting up, and soul music blasting out of every record store, Eugene Pitt somehow managed to get a major label, United Artists, to put out a Jive 5 record. In just a few weeks, everybody was glad they'd done it.
I'm a happy man. I'm a happy man. Whoa, 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 my baby. You look so good. Yeah, 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 my baby. Just like I knew you would. Tonight when we go out, I'll feel so proud. Walking hand.
I'm a Happy Man didn't do so well on the soul stations, but it became a huge pop hit, only missing the number one slot because Tom Jones was settled in there with What's Up Pussycat. Again, the follow-up never took off, which is really too bad, because A Bench in the Park is a fine record.
We can't stay at your house.
No, 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 no.
The family everywhere.
Everywhere.
We can't go to my house.
No, 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 no.
My folks are always there.
Always there.
But there.
This time, Eugene took the hint, although the Jive 5 continued to make records occasionally, charting as late as 1970. Mostly, though, he worked as a funeral director, playing occasional oldies shows, and working on his huge collection of snapshots, memorabilia, and souvenirs of a career that, by all the rules of the game, should never have happened at all.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Girl,
I never, never
This is Fresh Air. In her new book, My Own Alphabet, writer Bobby Louise Hawkins arranges her stories, poems, and essays under letter headings. According to the way she sees things, A is for attitude and aging, while D is for death, dying, and domestic nirvana, and H is for heartbreak. During the early 80s, Hawkins toured with performers Terry Gartwaith and Rosalie Sorrells in concerts of folk music and storytelling. Hawkins currently teaches writing at the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. I asked her to turn to the letter S in My Own Alphabet and read the story Silver Shoes.
People who live alone do what they want to do at any time of the day or night, without thought for anyone else, particularly not for persons who might disapprove and therefore stop them. So thought she who took the orange box down from a shelf in the closet late at night and put on her new shoes. They were lightweight loafers, shiny silver. They had cost her $5 on sale, marked down from $21.95. It was a hot night, the last of July, and she was visiting her mother, but would leave in 3 days. She was lying on cotton and polyester sheets printed blue and green and pink plaid. Except for the shoes, she was completely naked. Lying and reading a book, she had remembered the shoes she had bought 2 days earlier. She put them on, thinking she couldn't have done it. If she had still been with a husband she had been married to for 18 years, who had married a woman who was 27, he would have had attitudes about it, including the attitude that anything he thought about anything she did mattered as much as anything she thought about it. To be truthful, he would have believed that what he thought about her actions mattered more than what she thought about them. Unfair. But that wasn't quite the word. More than unfair, it was untrue. She continued to be puzzled about it, that he had believed himself to be so inherently preemptive. It had confused and distressed her when they were together. Now that they weren't together, it puzzled her when she thought about it, as now. She would never resolve it in her mind. But now, living alone, and all that adjusting gone through and done with, she thought it might be ideal to not be growing old alongside a man who would have had attitudes about it whenever it caught his eye. It was better to be alone and naked on a bed late at night in silver shoes.
What inspired that story?
That? Well, I had the silver shoes. I was visiting my mother. I was lying on this plaid set of sheets. The thought came to me, and it seemed to me an interesting enough thought to deserve writing down.
This, I guess, is a fairly autobiographical piece about having been married to someone for 24 years who married a woman who was 27, do you find yourself resenting men who marry women much younger than them?
Oh, it's such a commonplace. If one put much energy into resenting it, it would take up all one's time. I find myself feeling many different ways about it. It's not obviously the issue of my own life. I mean, it is apparently as a feminist theme almost. There's a place there for resentment in that somehow the general projection of what a man is and how a man continues is that a man can then constantly have this option and that women do not. I think there are other things than that. It somehow has been given men as if it were a privilege that they could marry someone younger. I've had relationships with younger men, and what was interesting in them to me, or what was almost a joke, and what I'll be writing about actually at one time, I mean in one of these next books I have projected, is that when I was married to, living with a younger man, one of the things that became patently clear was that he was asking of me the same kind of thing that younger women ask of older men, namely, he wanted it clear that I admired his mind as well as his body, etc. These things are apparently ageist more than they are sexist. I mean, that's simply the desire for a dignity within the relationship.
In one of your stories in here, you talk about the anguish that you used to have about collecting family stories and telling them, that you were self-conscious, you didn't want to make your family sound like they spoke in a Hollywood hillbilly dialect.
Right.
Is that how you started, by collecting stories that you'd heard friends and family tell?
Well, I grew up in Texas, and in Texas there's a heavy farm talking culture. Coming out of that, I was a very standard and usual kind of adolescent snob. That is, since I was getting language from the reading I was doing, my assumption was that my Texas relatives were, that I could collect their stories but improve on them, and in fact, when I started actually listening to them, they were honed right down to the nub. The advantage of a talking culture, of course, is that you're looking in someone's eyes, and as you know, when you're talking to someone and you're giving them a long story, you see the eyes glaze and you immediately start editing.
Right.
And it's so that for people who come out of a talking culture, when they realize that they can hark back to that talking culture and use that as an editorial principle, it saves them a few years of anguish.
I'd like for you to read something short from your new book called Spouses of Writers.
Chamfort said, Diderot used to say that a writer may have a mistress who fashions books, but must have a wife who fashions shirts. I could come up with endless variations on the theme of what a writer's husband should be.
I'll ask you for an example.
I beg your pardon?
I'll ask you for an example of what kind of what kind of writer's husband you'd like to see.
Well, the principal thing, it seems to me, is a man who's capable of being delighted by it when his wife's at work. I lived for years with a writer, and when he was working, I adored it. First of all, I really liked his work. Obviously, a writer is going to have a very hard time, male or female, if they're living with someone who doesn't actually care for their work. Otherwise, you're in constant collision, that place where you want to write and that place where you're a loving person with a person who matters terribly to you. Ideally, you want someone who cares for your work as you do and who is pleased when you're working rather than thinking of it as time somehow being taken from them.
Have you ever found a relationship like that?
No, I haven't. I see other people have it, though, so that I know it is possible. It just isn't my own personal history.
You were married for a while to the poet Robert Creeley. Were you writing at the time of that marriage?
No, I wasn't. Not until the relationship ended.
When you were with Creeley, and I know he wrote some poems about you, and I was wondering what the experience was like of reading poems about you, and if you were surprised seeing the way he wrote about you. If you were surprised at things he saw in you, or the way
well,
you describe
it? Well, it is a hard question to answer. Purely and simply, when he wrote wonderful poems about me in which he implied that I was wonderful, I liked it. When he wrote awful poems about me implying that I was awful, I didn't like it. The dilemma with being written about is simply that one finds oneself in the public mouth, and that's not so charming. But equally, there's a kind of dilemma in being with someone famous when one goes out and one sees that people adore oneself because one is some kind of, because of one's attachment.
Mm-hmm. Can you read us Vicious Valentine?
Certainly. Incidentally, this does not, this was not Creeley. This was someone quite different. Here I sit, all broken-hearted, loved a twit, but now we've parted. The present's grim, the future's brighter. He shouldn't have done it to a writer.
Did you get even by writing about this person?
Oh, one doesn't get even ever. I mean, that isn't even the issue. The issue is that one lives a life and that one's life provides kinds of material apropos where it is that one's mind's a functioning, sensual part of one's being. In fact, it seems to me that having vengeance as a focus for writing a book has produced a spate of really terrible books. I mean, badly written books. Vengeance just doesn't work. It tends to throw the thing out of torque. It misshapes.
What occasioned you to write Vicious Valentine?
Oh, I'd had a romance which had spiraled into an absurdity, and I was absolutely irritated at this person, and I wrote that as because I was actually delighted that there could be that statement with what I felt was a sense of humor in it.
Bobby Louise Hawkins' new collection of stories, memories, and quotations is called My Own Alphabet. It's published by Coffee House Press of Minneapolis. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Among the reports this evening, the story of the space shuttle Columbia safely in orbit, it is said. This is one of the Defense Department missions. Japan has a new prime minister. His name is Toshiki Kaifu, also the new president of the Liberal Democratic Party, the ruling party there. And a special report about a writing program for the homeless in Nashville. It's sponsored by a shelter for the homeless in Nashville called Matthew 25. Seminars and individual teaching, a program culminating in a public reading at a club in downtown Nashville. And some of the writers even have hopes of publications of their songs and stories.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The British Museum is falling down, Changing Places, and Small World are all novels by the British author David Lodge. Lodge's new novel is called Nice Work, and book critic John Leonard says it is.
In England, David Lodge is always compared to Kingsley Amis, which is unfair. Though they both write comedies of bad manners, Amis hasn't really been funny since Lucky Jim, and Lodge gets funnier with every novel, with time off for four books of criticism and a quarter century of professing English lit at the University of Birmingham. Besides, Lodge is clearly a much nicer person. In his latest novel, Nice Work, he's kind to almost everybody he makes fun of, and both sexes. Half of Nice Work is set inside the red brick University of Rummage. It's the sort of college novel likely to remind American readers less of Amis than of Mary McCarthy's Groves of Academe or Randall Jarrell's Pictures from an Institution. It's about the knowledge factory gone berserk. In this place, we're told, reading is work, reading is production, and what we produce is meaning. But the other half of Nice Work is about another sort of factory, producing automotive parts instead of knowledge, motors instead of meaning. When these two modes of production meet, there's a very messy dialectic. Robin Penrose is young, feminist, and Marxist, with a bad case of the semiotics. At Rummage, she teaches the 19th century English industrial novel, in which worthies like Dickens and Disraeli felt bad about the dark satanic mills, but failed to resolve, quote, the ideological contradictions inherent in their own situation in society. Because anything like a revolution was unthinkable for such novelists, they solved the personal problems of their characters by fortuitous marriage, miraculous inheritance, sudden death, or immigration to Australia. Personally, Robin doesn't believe in character. It's a bourgeois myth. Nor does she believe in love. Sexual desire, she thinks, was a play of signifiers, an infinite deferment and displacement of anticipated pleasure which the brute coupling of the signifieds temporarily interrupted. Novelists themselves, according to Robin, are capitalists of the imagination. He or she invents a product which consumers didn't know they wanted until it was made available, manufactures it with the assistance of purveyors of risk capital known as publishers, and sells it in competition with makers of marginally different products of the same kind. For reasons too preposterous to go into here, Robin teams up with Vic Wilcox, managing director of a local recession-threatened engineering firm of Metal Bashers, a blacking factory every bit as scary as anything in Dickens. Vic doesn't believe in love either. Until he finds Robin in his arms in unlikely Frankfurt, all Vic believes in is the profit motive. From Robin, Vic learns how to feel. From Vic, Robin learns to get real. Wouldn't you know it, but their personal problems and ideological contradictions are resolved by a legacy and a marriage proposal and immigration, by every coincidence except death. Meanwhile, we're treated to a romp through the competing jargons of the academy and postmodern capitalism, the savories of sex, the drearies of Thatcherite England, and the anachronistic peculiarities of the 19th century English novel. Nice Work is more than nice, it's entirely delightful.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Nice Work by David Lodge. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In his movie The Terminator, film director James Cameron made Arnold Schwarzenegger a cyborg assassin. In Aliens, Cameron pitted Sigourney Weaver against monsters from another planet. Next time on Fresh Air, James Cameron talks about his new underwater thriller, The Abyss. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.